our favorite topic, insurance, and I give the floor to Roberta.
Thank you. So, our board has now completed the discussion of the main concern and the implementation challenges expressed by stakeholders since IFRS 17 was issued, and decided to propose some amendment to the standard to ease implementation, having in mind the criteria set in October last year, which are summarized in the Appendix 2 Agenda Paper 3 for this meeting. The material in slide 3 for the meeting today does not reflect the most recent decision the board made at its March meeting, so I will just briefly mention those. In March, the board considers the concern and implementation challenges about the level aggregation and decided to retain the level aggregation requirement in IFRS 17 unchanged. The board also decided to propose additional transition relief about the use of the risk mitigation option at transition and to propose a scope exclusion for some credit card contracts that provides insurance coverage. That would add to the proposed scope exclusion for loans that transfer significant insurance risk that are mentioned under topic one in the presentation. At the April meeting next week, the board will consider the package of the proposed amendments as a whole and will discuss whether to give the permission to the staff to start the balloting process for the exposure draft of the amendment to IFRS 17. So our aim is to publish the exposure draft around the end of June. At this ASAF meeting today, we would welcome your views or any preliminary feedback on the proposed amendments. We would welcome your comments on the individual amendment following the order of the topics in the presentation, if possible. So I would start from topic one in slide four about loans for which the proposed amendment would give an option to apply IFRS 17 or IFRS 9 to some type of loans. And also, if you have any comment on the credit card exclusion that I just mentioned, in that case would be an exclusion from applying IFRS 17 and the requirement to apply other IFRS standards to those credit card contracts. So I would hand over to you. Thank you.
Chiara?
Yes, this project is a key focus for us, concentrating a substantive amount of EFRAG resources, and it has been so for many years. And coming to the tentative decisions, we certainly appreciate that the issues identified by EFRAG have been considered as requested. But at this point in time, EFRAG does not have a view on the tentative decisions of the IASB. We are progressing with the process in assessing the tentative decisions following our project plan. So basically, the Insurance Accounting Working Group providing inputs into TAG and TAG providing inputs to the board. And later this week, EFRAG board will discuss the strategic approach to next steps, including the comment letter.
No other comments specific to issue number one. Linda?
Rather than comment on issue number one, I thought I'd just take an opportunity to make some high-level comments relative to where we are and just reference the fact that I will weigh in on those issues that are important to Canada. Our TRG just met on Tuesday of last week, and so we do have that feedback. But, you know, directly speaking, and we talked about this at IFAS, I think we need to understand that this is a particularly complex project because everybody's starting from a different point. And change is difficult for preparers and auditors alike, but normally you're all changing from being here, even if you have some different practices, to being here. But now we're dealing with a whole range of complexity that's beyond that, and I think that's difficult for all. And then thinking back in my past as a preparer who did insurance accounting for 10 years, and it probably took me all of those 10 years to understand what was going on in my insurance business, but there you go, is that this industry, when they transitioned, certainly speaking from a Canadian perspective, when they transitioned to IFRS, they did all the other stuff. But they didn't transition their main business, and they're wrestling with that now. And there are so many embedded practices in that business that have survived over the years in terms of, you know, the local gap and local practices. And we just need to accept the fact that as we're moving all these different jurisdictions from different starting places going forward, and they're transitioning their main business, it's a level of complexity. And I think that the ISB needs to be commended for the fact that you're showing, I think, a great deal of flexibility in being willing to go into the standard and open up some problematic issues. But I do think that we need to understand that this is as far as you're going to go, and that we need to get that done so that we have a stable platform and we can then focus on implementation. So generally speaking, I'll weigh in on the specific issues, but from a Canadian perspective, I just wanted to make sure that we're all focused on that end result in terms of getting a quality standard implemented.
Thanks, Linda. Okay, well, I suppose that's very simple.
No one else has commented on this, and I've just it's got to be welcomed. I mean, I think that's why no one's really speaking on this one. But you know, in light of that point of saying your willingness to open up problematic areas, I mean, this one was clearly a significant issue that could be dealt quite cleanly, and you've done that, and you should be kind of welcome for it. I think to Linda's other point about the scope of changes that will be made, and you know, I think we're getting to the point where it's clear these are the only amendments that you are going to make. And clearly, we need to there's some detail to work out even with some of these. But I do think it's important for those who want to see much greater change that there is a clear rationale for the stage you've got to when you're not going any further. I think some of the earlier points, some of the earlier issues in the back end of last year that were discussed, I think there's a view that some of them were dealt with quite quickly and with a light touch, or the thinking was done behind the scenes and perhaps not as transparent. I just advise or recommend that as you go forward to, be it in the basis for conclusions or be it in supporting documentation, the fuller rationale for some of those limits you've placed is necessary, or else the debate will rumble on.
Jehun?
Thank you. We also agree with the tentative decision the board made on the loans that transparency risk. But I'd like to mention about the concern some of our stakeholders brought up. They concern about the consolidated financial statement. So if you are a non-insurance entity, which is a subsidiary and applying IFRS 9, but your parent company is an insurance company, applies IFRS 17, you will be required to apply IFRS 17 to, So I was thinking, we are thinking in a consolidated group, we have to comply same accounting policy to the same accounting, same contract. So we were worried, even though you are, even you are elect to apply IFRS 9, you'll be required IFRS 17 for the purpose of consolidating financial statement.
I think that the option would apply both to the consolidated financial statement of the separate account. So if you are applying IFRS 9...
portfolio choice. So if one part of the business makes the choice under IFRS 9 and a different part of the business makes the choice under 17 for different portfolios, they would retain that when it rolls up.
Okay. I think we are ready to go for the next topic.
Yeah, we can move maybe to topic two, that is on slide 5, which is about the acquisition cash flows that refer to contract renewals, for which the proposed amendment would be to recognize an asset for those cash flows until the renewals are recognized. And there will be an impairment test that need to be carried out at each reporting date. Do you have any comment, any views on this?
Linda?
So generally supportive. Happy with this change. Would ask that at the end of the day, when you finish kind of what you're going to do with all of these, that you stand back and look at disclosure requirements, some level of concern over the level of disclosures. And so just a general note on that one.
Your turn.
Okay. For topic two in slide five, we still have some concerns, just as the slide show that differing acquisition cash flows for renewal is not common in China. So our project team and some stakeholders still have some concerns. They think if the board decided to make this amendment, it needs to consider how to avoid it being used inappropriately in practice. For example, even there is no enough evidence, the loss will be deferred. They don't want to see this result. So their suggestion is, I suggest the board to set some strict preconditions for this amendment. For example, if an entity believes that certain insurance acquisition costs are not only related to the original insurance contract, but also related to the expected renewal ones, then the precondition is this expected renewal contracts must be highly probable. So that's the suggestion from our project team.
I sympathize with you. It was the one change that I voted against, because generally I think we capitalize way too much in IFRS. Okay. We can go on to...
Yes, so topic three in slide six is about the contractual service margin allocation in general model contract, for which the amendment would propose to consider both the insurance coverage for the allocation and the investment return service, if any.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chairman. Today I'm here representing the AOSSG Insurance Working Group, not as a current TIG member, so I'm just focusing on delivering the views from our member countries. This issue is about the capital allocation for general model contract. The views among members were diverse, depending on their understanding of the requirements, I think. Some insurers with the multinational operations said that this amendment is a fundamental change and system requirements need to be reworked based on the proposed amendment, and also commented that the extent of the rework would depend on the final wording of this amendment. For example, if the amendment allows for some flexibility in the determination of investment return services, then the impact on their implementation would be significantly less. On the other hand, others view this amendment as an extension of the current requirement of the standard rather than fundamental changes. I personally agree with this view in that this amendment simply requires a modification of the logics to allocate CSM in order to reflect the relative weighting of the benefits provided insurance service and investment service. Honestly, I guess this must be pretty tricky part, though.
Anthony?
I think we're also hearing very diverse and so in fact, complex views even from a single constituent. You know, really, the diversity comes from what kind of products it's going to be applied to. And I think I'd say there's sort of three different elements to that. There's one where, certainly for the UK, there's a view that a lot of UK annuities, which preparers thought were going to be addressed by this amendment, they don't think will be because of the narrow definition of an investment component. So I think there still is a concern that there are activities that some insurers will do over an extended period for which there will be no margin recognised. And during that period, they believe they're exposed to insurance risk, but taking this route, there isn't, and they're not meeting the narrow definition of investment component. So, that leads us to think, to look carefully at the definition of what is an investment component to ensure it's not become excessively narrow. Would be the first point. And the second point, I think, yeah, similar to yours, is I think in some cases there is a concern that preparers will be forced to try and analyse out investment components, and only to result in that making very little difference to the amounts being recognised and the timing of that recognition. And because those components are small, but there will still be a necessity to go through the process to show that's immaterial, we don't need to allocate to those. But I think there is and one area to look at is to what extent is this mandatory, to what extent should some flexibility be permitted in the way that is applied, or else it may just create unnecessary complexity late in the implementation process with no resulting or material changes to the recognition. Then there is a third group who say, well, this is hitting the mark for them. So there will be some products where this is a very good solution, there is a significant investment component, this is capturing it, and thereby it will be met. So as I said, there's real diversity. But I would just think particularly on, is the definition too narrow? And then in terms of the implementation of it, the response to an investment component, could that be too strict and mandatory and create unnecessary complexity without a resulting change in recognition?
Linda?
So some similarities. So our TRG expressed support with the caveat that in this particular case, because you're introducing a new term, that they need to see the words. And that was a theme that was consistent through all, that ultimately a lot of support, but need to see the words. And they're focused on, I think it's similar to what you're saying, Anthony, that that the CSM should be amortized over the delivery of service period, and they don't want the definition of the coverage period to be modified because of the investment component. So I think I kind of read between the lines that it's similar to what you're saying. And so I think at the end of the day, very, very sympathetic and support for this, with the notion of want to see the words so that we can make sure they get applied appropriately. So I think that's also similar to what you're saying.
Yeah, I think you're right. The words will help.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the next topic is on slide 7 and is about the reinsurance contract that we cover underlying onerous contract, for which the proposed amendment would affect the accounting of reinsurance contract held.
Supported.
Shall we move to slide 8, that is again linked to reinsurance, but concerned the application of the risk mitigation option that the board decided to propose to extend when reinsurance contract held are used to mitigate risk for contracts that are applied, accounted for applying rather than the approach. So it would be to expand the application not only from derivatives to derivatives and reinsurance contract.
Anthony?
I made the general point earlier on about needing a clear explanation and rationale for the limit of the changes being made, and I think in reinsurance it's going to be particularly important. Clearly with... if you're trying to reflect the economics of the business, you could give a completely free rein and to allow an entity to reflect what it thinks the underlying economics are. You will lose comparability. There will be some ability to abuse, perhaps. Or at the other end, you could say, we have to have very strict conditions and we follow a precise set of rules, and then the underlying economics aren't met. We know we're going to land somewhere in the middle of those two extremes, with some relief given around risk mitigation, but not as much as some wish. At the moment, without seeing the detail, one can't make a final conclusion, but my sense is further relief could be justifiable, some further flexibility allowed to reflect risk mitigation. But in the end, we need to know why this piece has been permitted and not other pieces. And I think it's really important for the subsequent debates that will be needed in advance of endorsement, et cetera, or indeed even in advance reflecting and responding to the exposure draft, that some time is spent really by the board really clarifying why they've landed where they have in that spectrum. You know, as far as this amendment goes, I'm supportive, but to say that was the right place to stop the line and not allow some more risk mitigation is a much more difficult question. I think it's incumbent on the board to help shape and future discussion by it, making a clear rationale for why this was as far as you were willing to go.
Okay.
Topic 5 is on slide 9 and is about balance sheet presentation and proposal to move from a presentation on a group level to a portfolio level to identify which are the assets and liabilities that need to be presented separately.
Patrick?
We still believe that on the face of the balance sheet, the different natures of the assets and liabilities that are captured in a combined asset or liability should be considered, because and that a definition for premium receivable should be developed, because there seems to be a different. There seems to be different approaches to the accounting amount of premium receivable, which has to be disclosed in the notes. So we feel it's good to go at portfolio level, but it still offsets assets and liabilities of different natures.
So you think there is too much offsetting? Or?
No, at the moment. You know, it is combining premium receivable, which is an asset, outstanding claims, which are a specific liability, and the remaining coverage. So this combination in one amount, we feel, is not informative enough. And it's also linked to the fact that in systems, basically, companies, to the best of my knowledge, I'm a little bit like Linda. I spent on the auditor side a number of years auditing insurance companies. They have insurance systems. They have systems for their underwriting, premium collection. This is something which is well established and which is defining how much is to be received. They have a system on outstanding claims as well. Since the claim has occurred, from that point, even with IBNRs incurred but not reported, this is very well. All of this is going to actuarial systems to compute remaining coverage, etc. So, by nature, in accordance with existing systems, we think that it's better to split. That rather than have a combined undescript amount based on a cash flow approach, we agree. It doesn't change the measurement, it's changing presentation. So.
Andre, did you want to react?
Yeah.
I guess we would say we don't think that we are offsetting, you know, assets and liabilities in that presentation, because we're looking at a contract. So you haven't got a separate asset for the premiums receivable and then a liability for the claims payable. It's one contract that is...
No, the liability could be to a third party. So it's not with the policyholder.
But it's all coming out of a contract.
From that contract, yes, the transaction we're accounting for.
Yes, but premium, frankly, I think the nature of assets and liabilities are different in this case.
Well, it's not a separate asset in the sense that it doesn't exist without the liability, the obligation that comes with it. So we're accounting for the transaction that that created both of those.
I don't think we agree to that.
Daryl?
I think this goes somewhat to the core of the way the standard works, because I agree with Patrick, you're correct in saying that some of the payments that are due under an insurance contract are not due to the policyholder, they're due to a third party. But clearly you can forecast that at the beginning, so that would suggest that you would have to have a separate liability depending on who the counterparty is going to be. I think what IFRS 17 attempts to do is to focus on the contract and say all of the cash flows that flow from that specific contract. I think the other issue that we've heard quite a lot about that you've raised in that you've just raised is the issue of systems. And I think that there is a concern around systems, and the portfolio approach would seek to resolve that by raising the level at which the determination is made. I think this interacts with the other comment you've made, because when we've talked to people about the systems constraints they have, the systems application they use right now is based on their definition of premiums receivable. And I agree with you completely. If we were to go down the route of separating out the receivable amount, I think we would have to have a common definition for what we mean by receivable. But I suspect that would imply the same systems constraint that people are struggling with now. If you pick the system I've got, I'm going to be happy. The definition for the system I've got. But if I pick a definition of premiums receivable that doesn't accord with my methodology, but I I'm asking the question, perhaps looking to the staff, I think this was part of the paper that we discussed. Okay.
Yes, it was.
So I think this was part of what the board would have considered in the process, of, in the decision that they got to.
Yes, okay. Yeah, we did.
All right.
Okay. Shall we go to the last topic? Slide 10 is about transition and in particular a modification that the board has decided to propose for the modified retrospective approach and the relief also for the fair value approach. So an additional modification would be added for claim settlement, that liabilities for claim settlement could be accounted for as part of the liability for incurred claims rather than liability for remaining coverage. And when the board was discussing the concern around the modified retrospective approach, the board noted that it's important probably to clarify in the basic conclusion that companies can still use estimate when applying IFRS 17 retrospectively. So this is something that is not mentioned in the presentation, but was helpful to note. Do you have any comment on this?
Yes, thank you. Yes. One member in our insurance working group raised and delivered a concern regarding the application of a modified retrospective approach. They asked the ISB to simplify the requirements of the historical data used in modified retrospective approach. And I know that these days, you know, many insurers and preparers are showing their concern, their interest in applying modified retrospective approach in order to get some portion of the profit, future profits at the transition date. As you know, there are three available approaches to calculate CSM at the transition date. Fair values tend to be, you know, have CSM almost to zero, so insurers don't like it, as long as insurers don't have equity issues at transition. Full retrospective approach is not practicable until the system is ready. Owing to those reasons, insurers are starting to looking at the modified retrospective approach, but it seems really restrictive to apply. That's the issue that our, you know, member country, you know, raised.
Patrick, yeah.
on transition, we have the same concern. The modified retrospective approach seems to be seen from a restrictive standpoint, because and in many cases you will be able to go back a number of years on long, very long term portfolios. You can go back 8, 9, 10 years, but then you will lack it will be impossible to simulate what it would have been from the beginning. So the extent to which reasonable estimates can be used in these circumstances for us is important to specify, because or people will be pushed in the direction of fair valuing, which is not necessarily the best of all options. So modified retrospective, the risk is that estimates be expected to be too precise to a certain extent. I'm not saying that they would be unreasonable, but they would be based on the best information available. And the definition today is very restrictive.
Linda?
So I would say we're hearing essentially the same things in Canada, that when they read the words around modified retrospective, they are concluding that perhaps they're going to be forced into fair value. And I think we would ask you to consider what you want the outcome to be, because we think that a reasonable approach to either retrospective or modified retrospective gives people better information. And so we would say that we would just ask you to take a look at that and make sure you're communicating clearly what your expectations are.
Martin.
Yeah, I'm hearing that also quite often, but I have never heard a kind of solution, what concrete in the modified retrospective we should change. Because when we debated that, I asked several people who said, okay, that is too restrictive. What exactly do you want that we should change in the modified retrospective, but I have not heard any suggestions other than, okay, you should be more open. But what does it mean? Should we allow, if you don't have reasonable and supportable data, we should allow it? So people who have unreasonable, not supportable data, they should use the retrospective approach then?
It's probably
is that the demand? Or? Yeah, because that is, and I'm hearing that so often, but I don't really, what should we do with that? That is my problem with that.
And I could also comment on the estimate that's coming up. That also came up in the board discussion at the time. And we noted that we would clarify, probably in the basis, that we didn't mean to preclude the use of estimates in the modified retrospective, but that is allowed, and we'll make sure that we clarify that in the write-up as well.
That would be helpful. Yeah.
I think we made a Martin, I think we made a proposal. I don't have it in mind now, but in the documents that we have sent, we made a proposal on this one, I think.
Okay. We welcome the simplification of the under the IFRS 17 regarding the transition. However, we still think that the simplification under the modified retrospective approach are still very difficult in practice. And we suggest providing more simplification regarding the transition.
Yes, Anthony.
I understand your point, Martin, that you aren't getting very concrete sort of proposals back. But I think the exploration of reasonable estimates would certainly help. But I don't think you can underestimate the problem here. That I think we all agree the best solution would be a full retrospective, and getting something as close to that as possible is the answer. We all know that there are two sort of principles, let's say, for measurement: a full retrospective or a fair value model. And we are talking about a sort of practical, expedient, and thereby slightly inferior third version. But preparers are really struggling with this, are really struggling to find a modified retrospective approach that they're allowed to apply, and thereby falling back to fair value. And It's like the risk mitigation question. It's clear that one needs to suspend some of the tighter conditions that would lead to a perfect answer. But I think it is, and we need to strike that balance correctly. And you may not yet have the concrete solution, but we can't just keep pushing back and saying, yeah, but you know, it's difficult to find this softening. We need to find a softening of these restrictions, because I think something that is close to the full retrospective will be better than Fair Valley, and it will be a better start to the life of IFRS 17.
But I'm not sure, because if you, for example, would open that and say, okay, you can use whatever kind of information you have, I don't know if that would end in better information, because that has an impact on the ZSM, and the ZSM can will determine your profit for several years. So is that better if that is based on not good information? I'm not so sure. Therefore, I would say then maybe that is a better fair value. And you are absolutely right. We have to find the right balance, and that is what we try to say, okay, if you have the data, then you use retrospective. That is the best information ever. I totally agree. Then if you don't have the data, then you give some modifications, but overall you need reasonable and supportable information. Yeah. And I have done also in my practice a lot of conversions. When it is not that you need all the data, you can use estimates. And estimates, but these estimates must be reasonable and supportable. And I'm not sure, but I think it's a kind of a problem between preparers and auditors also, that they maybe not have done in this industry's kind of transition to such a big standard, because I have not seen so big problems in other kind of industries. We also have long-term contracts and have to go back, but say using estimations, reasonable and supportive.
And I do believe that you're right there, but further clarity and guidance on
what estimates,
whether the estimates that they can make in these situations, because at the moment I think there is, and I think your analysis is probably correct, it is something new in this transition and becoming more of an acute problem in this transition compared to previous one. But it is such an acute problem that it could well be that people conclude and put a very high bar on what a reliable estimate is, and that thereby rules out the modifier. You see what I mean? So whether it's around guidance or exploring the notion of these estimates to empower people to make confident yet supportable estimates is also a way of exploring.
No, I fully support what is being said. Preparers, I think they have ways to have reliable estimates, but long term, it's difficult to go back 30 years. So I think the discussion will take place, and it's a former auditor that's telling you this, that the auditors might say, to a certain extent, is that reliable enough? And that's exactly what Anthony said, i.e. it's a threshold of reliability. For long-term, very long-term operations, it's difficult. I have seen cases of mergers where you were taking on board old portfolios, and going to the fair value was certainly not obviously the best solution. So, in general, I support better guidance between what was in IFRS 4, where you were taking, you know, the figures as they were, and fair value. Fair value also requires a lot of is extremely sensitive, because you can do a lot of assumptions to get to fair value. You can protect, to answer Martin's concern, you can also protect your contractual service margin for a long, long time using the proper parameters. So what is the best information? The best information linked with the past with some reasonable estimates for me is better information than, you know, starting afresh with a fair value for everything, which in which case you will be absolutely it will be impossible to compare over the past.
Daryl?
So I think it's just worth picking up a couple of things that I've heard. I think the first one is, Anthony, you're right, in that what we've essentially got at the two bookends here, we have two principle-based approach. A fair value approach clearly defines what it is that you're aiming for. A fully retrospective approach clearly defines what you're looking for. The approach that we're dealing with in the middle here is now something that can't be principle-based, because there, and I think you and I had this conversation about you can clearly define what a closed door is, and you can clearly define what an open door is, but it's very hard on a principle basis to define something in between those two states. And that's what a modified retrospective approach is essentially doing. It's somewhere in between without actually being able to define what. So I think the approach we've taken at the moment is to respond to the specific requests we had for modifications that we can say, start with this objective, but you're allowed to modify if these specific things happen. And then we also responded to the question mark that the way that some of the words were written in the modified retrospective approach made it feel like people had to go that extra step in terms of reliability. And we think the words that Martin quoted, which reasonable and supportable, are a thing that you can aim for from that perspective. A lot of the views we heard from people during the process of talking about this was about the concern that they had to have the exact information. So I think we've probably resolved a lot of those issues out there at the moment. And then I think you are correct. To the extent that there is something we've turned down, I think we need to be very clear why we have turned down. But the one thing I would like to make the statement on is I don't think you can have a principle-based exception. And that was, I think, the big request that we were getting is a principle-based exception. I just don't see how that is a definable thing.
And I think that's an important point, because we've made the point that if people have had specific further exemptions that they want us to consider, I think we'd be willing to consider those. But the specific suggestions that have been made so far, from what I remember them, are really to say something along the lines of approximating the modification. You can't really approximate a rule, and so it doesn't really work. And that's a challenge.
Okay. Any other comments?
Okay. Thank you. On the topics which have not been addressed so far, or have been addressed and rejected, a couple of comments, if I may. On the level of aggregation, we would like to say again that we are concerned from an operational standpoint with the fact that there is no exception to annual cohorts in case of intergenerational mutualization organized by regulation or by contract, because I think that later today there will be an exchange of views on the example that we produced and that has been used, and the interpretation of it, the conclusion that we reach is different. So that's interesting to see how we can, from the same example, reach different conclusions. We feel that in the case of intergenerational mutualization, annual cohorts are an unnecessary burden, and the cost of it is not insignificant. The cost of it is material. We are also a bit concerned by the quote-unquote ambiguity in the wording of paragraphs 14 to 24, if my memory is correct. The general approach seems to be a top-down approach, moving from portfolio and then moving down to groups of contracts. But further down, there is some sort of implication that it could be done. If it's not obvious, it should be done bottom up. And I think that might be a little contrary to the idea of creating communities of policyholders, which I call mutualization. And that could lead to a different granularity of group of contracts, as compared, for instance, to Solvency II or to the pricing methodologies of company of insurance companies. So therefore, we would welcome a clarification on this topic, which would be that when a company organizes a community of policyholders on the basis of a certain pricing, this is probably the best granularity that is the most relevant for accounting purposes, because you will always find individual or smaller subpopulations that will be onerous, even when they are taken in a population of policyholders that is conceived as a larger population. I take the example of motor industry or motor insurance or health. You can always subdivide and get to smaller populations when, in fact, by agreement, these populations are treated as one. Of course, that can evolve over time, but the pricing is done for that global population. So we are fearing that could unbalance the mutualization systems that are operating today. Mutualization in the sense of what I was saying.
Can I ask a question? Yes. So there's two things you said that I'm not sure I understand. One is the way you're using mutualization.
Yeah.
And the second thing is you talk about by agreement, meaning the pricing by agreement. And do you mean by legislation or regulation? So could you clarify those?
Yes. As regards by agreement, it can be implicit. If I am the owner and the driver of a car, I'm going to join a population of car drivers that are insured. Mm-hmm. I might pay a little more or a little less depending on my experience, mm-hmm. my age, category of car, location. This is the conditions to join the population. But as soon as I am in that population, I am guaranteed the same, because the pricing of that population has been conceived and designed as one.
Okay.
So that's what I call a mutualized population.
Oh, okay.
And in this case, and it's not, yeah. I know that it's a word that is difficult to define and to share. But that's what I can use, community of policyholders, if you wish.
Okay.
But, you know, people move into the system on the basis of a pricing that has been determined by the company, and therefore the pluses and minuses, because there are always pluses and minuses, are in fact mutualized or shared by the global population as defined.
Whereas I don't think we'd use that word in that setting. That's okay. That's fine.
Actuaries like to use cohort.
Yeah.
Well, cohort as a cohort, if you wish.
1 year.
Okay. Jay Hume?
Yeah. Thanks. Now, we are expecting the exposure draft will be published end of June. It's not related to this issue, though. We are just wondering how much time you will allow us to have to review the exposure draft, because I'd like to ask you to consider to some countries who need to translate their own languages in order to request our stakeholders for comment. And we need also effect analysis afterwards. So, you know, I don't know what is the enough time for review, but some say maybe at least 120 days, or some say not less than 90 days. But please consider for the enough time, you know, for those countries who can, you know, who may need extra time.
We were planning to ask in the May meeting for the board to set a comment period, and in that we need to consider balance the competing needs for dealing with this urgently enough that we get something finalised that's useful in terms of the effective date that we've set, and at the same time to make sure that we get a suitable amount of time for commentary, which includes translation time as well.
Alberto.
Yeah. Our stakeholders are generally positive on your tentative decision and amendments. One point on which they are still unhappy is the level of aggregation. Same reason as explained by Patrick, more or less. And therefore, they would suggest that in the forthcoming ED, you put the question about this level of aggregation. You explain why you have not reconsidered and ask whether there's still this is still a contention point.
You want us to ask that?
Yeah.
We know the answer. We know the answer. Nobu?
Yes, thank you. Our board has not discussed the possible amendments that are presented in the paper, but nonetheless, I'd like to convey the views of the Japanese life insurers. They're pretty much similar to what Alberto just mentioned. They do welcome the possible amendments that are proposed, but they still are not satisfied with the decision to retain the requirements related to the level of aggregation.
John Hirk.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman. Now I would like to deliver two observations made by AOSSG Insurance Working Group members. One is about the one-year deferral of the effective date, and the other is about Tianjin. Regarding the one-year deferral, most preparers understand the intentions of the ISB, but there are still mid- and small-sized insurers out there expressing their concerns about the remaining time, given that there is a shortage of expertise and resources available, and the requirement for system keep changing as IFRS 17 is not yet stable. Again, this is not my view, but the views from the working members. Last but not least, it is a little bit awkward and embarrassing moment as one of the TRG members, but today, I'm here as a representative of AOSSG. I would like to deliver the Hong Kong's comment that the ISB should continue to consult with the TRG after each April meeting. As you know, the objective of the TRG is to provide a public forum to help stakeholders interpret questions raised on implementation, which depend on the wordings of the final standard, and also commented that some stakeholders in Hong Kong may be waiting for the wordings of the exposure draft before submitting their questions to the TRC. That's all.
Linda?
Thanks. So just a couple of general comments. I don't know, but won't be surprised if you hear from our preparer jurisdictions the notion of a two-year versus a one-year deferral that has been on the table, although it's been a little bit quieter lately. They reiterate the notion that they want to see the changes. They're still concerned about the availability of systems that will give them the information they need, including the information they need for disclosures. And they have emphasized that. And then the last statement in summary was we did have our TRG take a look at the list of the full list of 25 issues discussed and got the feedback. They're generally okay with the tentative decisions made by the IASB and the rest of the other issues not addressed in ASAF slides, but they want to see the wording of the amendments, and with regard specifically to the level of aggregation, they have no significant concerns.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of this discussion. I suggest we go for lunch and come back at 1:45.